Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Let us dig into the headlines. The 2023 NEA Jazz Masters are violinist Regina Carter, saxophonist Kenny Garrett, and drummer Lewis Hayes. And the 2023 A.B. Spellman NEA Jazz Masters Fellowship for Jazz Advocacy is producer, archivist, publisher, and proponent for the legacy of bassist Charles Mingus, her late husband, Sue Mingus. The tribute concert, marking the NEA's 40th anniversary of the NEA Jazz Masters program, is scheduled for April 1st, 2023 at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. Radio host Eric Jackson, ordained as WGBH-FM's Dean of Boston Jazz Radio, will be inducted into the Massachusetts Broadcasters Hall of Fame on September 22nd. Tonight, Thursday, July 21st, drummer Jared Schoenig and his big band perform at the Jazz Gallery in New York City for two sets. For more information, jazzgallery.org. Tonight at Elastic Arts in Chicago, Illinois at 8:30 p.m. CST, the duo of tenor saxophonist Nicolaj Clemens and drummer Julian Kirshner. For more information, elasticarts.org. Also tonight, saxophonist Yosvani Terry and his quartet perform at Cumbia Jazz in Santa Cruz, California, 7 p.m. PST. For more information, cumbiajazz.org. At Birdland in New York City, inside of Birdland Theater tonight, July 21st, vocalist and pianist Peter Ayres and his band. Tomorrow night, July 22nd through Sunday, July 24th, multi-instrumentalist Gunhild Carling for two sets. And inside of Birdland Jazz Club tomorrow night, Friday, July 22nd, the Birdland Big Band. And on Sunday, July 24th, the Danny Jonacucci Big Band and Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Ensemble. For more information, birdlandjazz.com. Performances happening tomorrow night, Friday, July 22nd. Vibraphonist Bill Ware and the Upstate All-Stars scheduled to perform at Jazz at Senate Gallery in Kingston, New York last Friday have been rescheduled to tomorrow night, 8 p.m. For more information, jazzstock.com. Celebrating their new release, Endumbrations, on FIP Recordings, reed player Josh Sinton, pianist Jed Wilson, and drummer Tony Falco perform at iBeam in Brooklyn, New York, 7 p.m. For more information, ibeambrooklyn.com. And at the Center for New Music in San Francisco, California, Experimental Sounds with the group Harjo, 7:30 p.m. PST. For more information, centerfornewmusic.com. This Friday and Saturday night, July 22nd and 23rd at the Jazz Forum in Tarrytown, New York, pianist Cyrus Chestnut and his trio for two sets. And on Sunday, July 24th, vocalist Liz Rosa and ensemble for two sets. For more information, jazzforumarts.org. Trumpeter Nat Woolley and his quartet Columbia Icefield perform at TVI in New York City on Monday, July 25th, celebrating their second release, Ancient Songs of Burlap Heroes, on Pyroclastic Records. For more information, natwoolley.com. NIAC Jazz Week in NIAC, New York continues through Saturday, July 23rd. Tonight, the Anita Brown Band. Tomorrow night, the Arturo O'Farrell Quintet. And on Saturday, the Vincent Herring Quartet. For more information, rcjbs.org. Pianist and composer Armin Danilian performs at Gateways Inn in Lenox, Massachusetts on Saturday, July 23rd with bassist John Menigan at 8 p.m. For more information, gatewaysinn.com. The 20-piece Swing Time Big Band performs in Fall Village, Connecticut this Saturday, July 23rd as part of Music Mountain Twilight Jazz. For more information, musicmountain.org. Jazz Sundays at the Falcon in Marlboro, New York. This Sunday, July 24th, 7 p.m., vocalist Sheila Jordan, pianist Alan Broadbent, and bassist Harvey S. For more information, liveatthefalcon.com. Guitarist Frank Mignola's Guitar Night with special guest guitarist Pasquale Grasso at Birdland Theater inside of Birdland in New York City on Wednesday, July 27th. For more information, birdlandjazz.com. And a solo guitar performance by Margaret Slovak at Chez Z American Bistro in Austin, Texas on Wednesday, July 27th. For more information, chez-z.com. And now for new releases. Coming out tomorrow, Friday, July 22nd, vocalist Laura Crema and guitarist Bill Kuhn's self-release String Songs and pianist Steve Hudson's The World of Steve Hudson on Grooveaholic Music. Other new releases out now. Guitarist Peter Jansen's self-release, Getting to Here. Trumpeter Natsuki Tamura's Sleeping Cat at the audio platform Bandcamp. Vocalist Deb Rasmussen's self-release, Unspoken. And guitarist Steve Tibbetts' Hellbound Train, an anthology on ECM. All news items have been gathered from various media sources. For the latest updates, contact the source, venue, or business. Remember, I'm just the messenger. My guest is drummer, percussionist, composer, arranger, and producer Peter Kogan. His Ogan Note Records release is Just Before Midnight that came out last month. So I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Glad to be here, Cheryl. Thank you.
In the press release, you revealed that the music for Just Before Midnight was conceived during lockdown, rehearsed, and performed for your neighbors. I mean, who wouldn't want a free concert in their neighborhood? Where is your neighborhood?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, not too far from the state capital, but I have a beautiful backyard. And when the lockdown occurred, I just was so frustrated not being able to play. I had tried playing with people online. There are various systems that try and allow musicians to play together at the same time. We tried that and it didn't work very well. There was always a time delay that made it almost impossible to play anything other than very slow music. So once the weather got better, I invited people over and I started inviting people over to play. I went around the neighborhood and dropped leaflets on everyone's doorstep saying, I'm going to be playing music. If you're concerned about that or don't like it, let me know. But it turned out that the neighbors loved it. So for almost, you know, every couple of weeks, I was inviting people over that summer. And as it happened, I had spent a lot of time during the lockdown writing music and completing old projects that hadn't had time to do, kind of forced my hand as a composer of music. to complete some projects. And then that led to inspiration for writing new things as well. So it was a productive time, a difficult time for the whole world and for the country and so on. But it was good for me to be able to, it was almost like going to one of those places where people go to compose, where you're all by yourself, you know. So it was a good time in that respect. And that once things got going again and the clubs opened, particularly before the Delta variant hit and the Omicron variant hit, the clubs were suddenly packed with people, and I had a number of engagements, and I was able to put together the two bands that I had written for, a quintet and a septet. And I was able to prepare these tunes for recording by playing them out and seeing how they worked and making those little corrections that you make in those situations.
Was it a surprise to your neighbors that you're a upstanding practicing musician?
I guess they must have heard the noise coming out of my basement, you know, over the years. I think certainly my adjacent neighbors knew and were never complaining about the noise. My wife's a flute player, and of course they hear her practicing and teaching in the front of the house. The sound of the drums coming out of the basement, I'm sure they could hear too at certain times. They seemed fine with it, and they were very enthusiastic when they started hearing these outdoor concerts, like a jam session.
Yeah, and you got new fans.
Right.
Now, for this release, you utilized a quartet, a quintet, a sextet, and a septet. That's like 10 additional people that you had to herd.
Right.
How did you broach the idea to these musicians of using four different ensembles?
You know, it never really came up among the musicians because, for instance, when we did the gigs with the septet, with the larger group, part of that gig would be playing one of the quartets or even two of the quartets within the gig. We'd break down and we'd do those two tunes. One was Ode to Coltrane, and the other was I Dream of Danny, very different. But I almost always include those when I was playing with the septet out. Similarly, when I was working with the quintet, which just had a slightly different, you know, different bass player, different keyboard player, the two main horns were the same. But I would also do that. I would break it down to the quartet for Ode to Coltrane. I didn't have a guitar in the quintet, so I couldn't do the other tune. But that's how it played out. So everyone knew I was getting these tunes ready for, they were new tunes and I wanted to record them. So when we started the sessions, there was the first session was just the quintet, but we also played the quartet Ode to Coltrane, Ode to JC. And on the starting with the second and third recording sessions, we did the larger groups. The last session, here's a secret for you. The last session we had leftover Hindsight by Cedar Walton, which was a septet version. And the guitar player got COVID that week, as I remember. And he had to bow out of that recording session. So we decided to do it with just the six players without the guitar. That particular arrangement, the guitar wasn't too essential. So that's how Hindsight got recorded as a sextet. And then on the same session, we did the quartet. I think we had done the quartet the previous week. So I guess the quartet was done on the second session. So there you are. We managed to get it all done in three sessions.
So either you're incredibly organized or you became incredibly organized through this process to get this accomplished.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. It was it seemed to go pretty well. We did maybe three takes on each tune, and I think only two takes on Isle of Kai. And the guys were well prepared. They played great. They're super relaxed and cooperative. And we may have punched in a few solos, you know, in terms of the final mix, you know, borrowing a solo from take two or take three to make the final mix. But it all went very smoothly.
Spoke with another musician who straddles jazz and improvised music and classical music. Mm-hmm. Along with those two genres, since the late 60s, you've played in rock and blues bands. Mm-hmm. And for 29 years, you were the principal timpanist with the Minnesota Orchestra.
That's right.
Would you give us a bird's eye view on how the business of being such a versatile player for over 50 years has changed? For instance, do you still get calls to play in rock and roll bands?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't. My contacts in the rock and roll area were all in the New York area because I spent 6 years in New York in my 30s playing drums and basically taking whatever work came my way. And those guys, I'm still in touch with some of them, but they're not here in Minnesota where I've been living. So my connections here are more in the jazz world. Once I started branching out from the orchestra here, I started just talking to the jazz musicians locally and asking them to play with me, jamming with them, inviting them to play on gigs. And that sort of led to a larger and larger number of musicians I could contact to play with.
And tell us about what's happening at petercogantimpany.com.
Okay. while I was in the classical field, and actually, you know, even as a student, I was very intrigued with the idea that the kettle drums as an orchestral instrument had changed over the years and gotten more and more sophisticated, where you could play a melody with the pedals and do all kinds of chromatic things, whereas the early timpani were basically tuned almost like a snare drum with a key going around, and you really had only two pitches per piece, you know.
Boom, 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 boom.
Exactly. You got those two pitches, that C, the tonic and the dominant. And modern instruments are bigger and more resonant. The earlier instruments are much smaller. They came right from the military. They were used on horseback initially as signaling instruments and as to try and create a frightening sound for the enemy of the of whatever army they were. So this is, we're talking about the 1500s, 1600s, kettle drums were on horseback. So I got a chance to copy an original set of kettle drums from about 1680, 1700, somewhere in there, 1700. Very small drums, horseback size, small enough to be put on a horse. And I had a chance to copy those exactly. And I was able to locate the origin of those particular instruments. So I started building Hessische Baroque Pauken, which means Hessian Baroque timpani. And those drums seem to be very successful with the early music people in this area. Mm-hmm. And so I made another set for sale, and that set sold pretty quickly. And last December, I've also built classical era timpani. Same reason, smaller than modern timpani, but used for like Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven, tuned with hand screws where you go around the drum and have to tune it by hand. Again, for the boom, 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 like you say, the tonic and the dominant, slightly larger than the Baroque timpani. And so I was able to sell a bunch of sets of those too. I had a wonderful artisan in town who did just a gorgeous job on the hardware. So the drums looked beautiful as well as sounded really good. So pretty much at the end of that phase, unless somebody commissions me to make another set of drums, I'm not going to start making more of them and then try and sell them. So, but it's the website is still up, Peter Cogan Timpani, and we'll see what happens.
But if you build them, they will come. So you got to build more.
That's what happened. And I use the sets that I own to play with the local. There's a Lyra Baroque Orchestra here in Twin Cities. It's called the Minnesota Bach Society Lyra Baroque Orchestra. And every year they do the Christmas Oratorio by Bach. They might do the Messiah. They've done the Easter Oratorio and some other concerts. And these are wonderful for me just to keep my hand in the timpani world with a very specific kind of playing for early Baroque music. It's been great to do that. I'm happy not to do the big orchestral works anymore that I did when I was timpanist full time.
All right, Peter, as we come to the end of this interview, is there something I didn't ask you, a question you'd like to answer, something upcoming, a project that you'd like to let us know about?
Sure. Upcoming, I have a couple of engagements where I'm using a band I put together with some friends here. We call it the Bird and Diz Legacy Quintet. And what we've done is we've taken the wonderful compositions of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and just playing those exclusively on the engagement. And it's been fun to go through those tunes and pick up our favorites and learn new ones. And I have one of those concerts coming up on July 29th. It's actually in a room at Orchestra Hall and called the Atrium. And I also have a quartet with a wonderful musician in town named Brian Grivna, who used to be Buddy Rich's lead saxophonist in the 1970s. He's a phenomenal saxophone player, and we're doing a quartet gig coming up on August 4th. On top of that, I'm doing a blues gig, believe it or not, after all this time, with Jonathan Kalb, who's a New York City Blues Hall of Fame inductee. And we're playing on August 13th at the Metronome in St. Paul. So these are things coming up for me this summer that I'm really looking forward to.
For more information, PeterCoganMusic.com. And now for some music.
Thank you. Sur ta bouche, mais voilà-t-il pas que j'allais rater mon solo.
From cult French producer Pierre Barreau's record label, Sarava, a compilation of music from the 60s and 70s titled Samba and Other Hallucinatory Grooves, reissued by We Want Sounds. We heard Je Jouais le Piano, vocalized by Jacques Higelin. The piece was one of the first recorded for the label and has never been reissued, until now. The release comes out tomorrow, Friday, July 22nd. And before that, taken from the same session where they first played together, reed player Daniel Carter, pianist Matthew Shipp, bassist William Parker, and drummer Gerald Cleaver with Welcome Adventure Volume 2 on the Brooklyn, New York City-based record label 577. We heard Mask production. You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com, info@wgxc.org, feedback@wgxc.org, or leave a 3-minute message at area code 518-291-WGXC. Our website is wgxc.org. My interview is with bassist, composer, and publicity and communications co-manager with Crossover Media, Zachary Swanson. He debuts with the group Trio Zolo, saxophonist Derek Michaels, and percussionist Dalias Najo on the 577 Records release, In Flower, In Song. It's due out on August 19th. So, thank you for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Well, thank you for having me. Pleasure.
And of course, this isn't the first time we've talked.
No, not at all.
No, I think it might have been last year.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
But now we're talking about your new release, and you'll have to pronounce it for me.
All right. So yes, the band name is Trio Zolo. Though I should say that word is actually an Aztec word. And the language is Nahuatl, their language. So the traditional pronunciation would be more like Xolo. But for sort of our purposes, we are Trio Zolo.
Okay. So the three members of Trio Zolo are from different parts of the world and are of different heritages.
So Dalias Najo is our drummer, and he's originally from Lithuania, has been living in New York City for a number of years. So he's back and forth a lot, and I happened to connect with him in New York, maybe 8 or 9 years ago or so. And Derek Michaels, the saxophonist, is from Baltimore, where he still resides. And I was living there when I was going to college. I'm originally from Massachusetts, so I met up with him there, and we've sort of, you know, continued our collaboration this entire time. And although I think sort of all of us have different backgrounds, there's definitely like a shared interest in a range of music. One of those, of course, being sort of improvised jazz. And I do think that sort of everyone's different perspective contributes to a sort of unique, unique perspective on this type of music.
Yeah. And you yourself are of Mexican heritage.
Yes, it's correct. So my mother is from Mexico. So I'm half Mexican. My dad is a sort of mixed bag of other things. That's something that I guess has maybe like the older I get, come more like focused in my personal identity, I would say. Mm.
So you talked about when the three of you met. How did the three of you musically converge, and what convinced you all to put out a record at this time?
So basically I had, you know, Dalias I met, as I said, like in New York, and we just ended up on a little bar gig together. And it was someone that I really felt comfortable. I really liked his sort of like probing energy, and just this sort of like feeling that anything could happen in the music. And as I mentioned, Derek and I have been working together for, you know, since I was in school, like over a decade now. And they're just two people that I really have felt like an intrinsic connection with musically. So the other thing is I always enjoyed the sort of chordless group in music. I like the sort of expansiveness that the saxophone bass drums combo has. So at some point, Derek was in town in Brooklyn just visiting, and I thought, you know, why not just put together a session? So we met up in a practice room. We didn't even have a gig or anything. Basically just playing for fun. And at once it felt like really like, you know, this is like my thing with Derek. This is my thing with Dalius, and the two combined in a really, you know, a nice way for me. So I think it was pretty early on, just really from that one session that I felt like it was a group that I wanted to continue with. And then, you know, even though we're all sort of located or, you know, a little bit all over the place as far as like where we are in our mm-hmm. schedules, it's not a band that unfortunately is able to practice or get together or play gigs all that regularly. So, you know, one way to just keep the movement of the group going was to, you know, play whatever shows we can and then also document the group really. So that's sort of where I came to say like, you know, hey, this is a band that I really want to, you know, I want to make sure that there is like some sort of catalog of this really just for myself, you know. And that's sort of how the record came to be created, I guess.
Yeah. What were some of the reasons that you chose to record on Brooklyn, New York-based 577 Records?
So that label is one that I've worked with, I guess, I don't remember the year of the first thing, but it's been numerous years. And Federico Ughi is the owner of the label with Polly Barnes, his wife. And I guess I probably met them fairly early on in my time in New York too. And he's another a fantastic drummer and someone that I also had a really strong connection with right away. And the label has just for years been putting out really, really creative, interesting music. I'm just a fan of the label, like aside from my own involvement in it. Mm-hmm. I think they do great stuff. I like their approach. And at the time that we recorded it, you know, I didn't have a label. I approached them after the fact, but it was because I thought it sort of fit in with what they're doing. And, you know, of course, to be in the catalog is fantastic for us. And, but generally, like I said, like I just enjoy it. They're good people and I like the label. So it was sort of a natural fit for that.
Yeah, I think you fit perfectly with them. I have spoken with Federico and I enjoy their label and their catalog is growing.
Yeah, it's amazing. They have a lot of stuff coming out. And, you know, I feel like every year it's getting more and more recognition that they deserve, I guess. So, it's nice to see where that started a long time ago and where it is now.
Yeah. You use gut strings for a, quote, dark and woody tone. Catgut or gut strings are made from the natural fiber found in the walls of animal intestines.
Correct.
You.
Yeah.
In your playing experience, mm-hmm. how do you compare using coated steel strings to gut strings based on cost and durability?
Okay, so that's a specific part of gut string usage. So cost, they're a lot more expensive. And the cheaper options, there are a couple that are like okay, but unfortunately, I think if you want to really get the benefit of the gut strings, the better ones are much more expensive.
And what are we talking about as far as expense? Are we talking $50 for a set?
No. So I mean, I think so that album I recorded using all plain gut strings. So some gut strings are wound with various materials, and you know, I don't want to say almost no one, but it's pretty uncommon to have the full set of plain gut strings. Oh. I don't remember the exact cost, but upwards of $500 for the set.
A set of strings?
Yeah. And though I have to say, those strings that are on that record were, they're like a one-man guy who's making boutique gut strings somewhere in the Midwest. It's kind of this like weird world. Damian Blugalecki is his name. And unfortunately, I think he's in semi-retirement. So I have since, you know, gotten other strings just for the for that. But yeah, so, you know, comparatively to steel strings, which are, you know, still, I guess, bass strings are kind of expensive in the scheme of instrument strings. They're considerably more expensive. And durability wise, it's kind of interesting because I think a lot of people may say that they're not as durable. And I've certainly snapped strings before. But that particular set that was on this recording, I had for years and years. So I think it's sort of like a quality analysis. And also there's just a little bit of the luck of the draw with those. Like sometimes something will happen. They're a lot more sensitive to weather. So say your bass is in like a less than ideal condition for whatever reason for a little bit, like the string might get really fuzzy and fray and things like this. So as far as cost, they're more expensive, unfortunately, but you know, it's a unique playing experience that, you know, I really find a comfort in.
Again, ew. You know, animal intestines, ew.
Yeah, I've had a few people come up and ask about them, and they're shocked, really. Sort of an antiquated thing now.
Yeah, now PETA knows who you are.
Exactly, yeah.
Zachary, your day job with the music promotions company Crossover Media has you working with jazz and classical artists. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. You're working with the artists and groups and their management.
Yeah.
As they come to Crossover Media for their publicity needs, what are some of your silent requests to them before they contact you? You know, in your head, are you like screaming, get your shit together before you call me?
Well, you know, one thing, I guess I totally like the spirit of the question resonates with me, but at the same time, a lot of artists are sort of confused what promotion really entails. And some people come to us with really no idea of like what they need to do. And first of all, I would say it's great if you're able to budget for promotion, I think it's fantastic. But you know, there wouldn't be anything, if someone hadn't even recorded and they just want to get information, that's completely valid. And I think that they actually should to sort of like have some idea of what to do in the future. So the only thing that we really, I think would really be most important is like, if we do start the campaign and we schedule stuff, just like maintain a good calendar, you know, so like the artist, of course, and of course, we always like try and make everything as easy as possible. But I'm sure you know how frustrating it is, just like we do if people like miss an interview or these sort of things. So that's really like the one, like, just don't do that. And then everything else will be fine, you know. But yeah, I mean, anything else, if someone is sort of confused about what the process is or what exactly we're doing, like that's all fair game, you know, and I think it should be openly discussed with anyone at any stage in the game, really.
You're so polite. I'd be throwing expletives at them every, you know, every conversation, but you know, that's just me. I'm just a mean person. But
not at all.
But Zachary, as an artist with a new release, do you follow your own advice?
Yeah, I definitely try to. I mean, I have multiple, I had at least three reminders for this interview because, of course, I want to be respectful of your time and represent myself well, too. So, yeah, for sure, I try to be as on top of it as possible. Now that I've said that, I'm worried that I'm going to somehow mess something up in the future catastrophically.
Well, I'm sure there'll be someone there to catch you. Hint, yeah. Hint, her name is Amanda.
It makes things easier for sure.
All right, Zachary, as we are coming to the end of this interview, is there something, a question I didn't ask you, is there something you'd like to tell us? Again, hint, hint, release party.
Okay, so I wouldn't have thought of it, but because of that amazing clue, thank you. No, we have, so the album comes out August 19th. Again, it's on 577 Records. I think you can hear one single track on their Bandcamp page right now. And we do have a CD release show in Brooklyn. It's at Young Ethel's on August 27th at 8 p.m. I think we're just gonna do one set. So yeah, you know, this band hasn't played together for a minute, and I'm really excited about that. We're definitely going to be playing in Baltimore the night, or maybe the night, the day or two before. I haven't quite pinned down the details, but we'll be there. And you know, hopefully we'll have other shows too, and working on a few other things, but those are the ones that are at least immediately likely. But you know, really the only thing I want to say, Cheryl, is thank you, and your programming is fantastic. I've gotten so much out of it, and you know, I appreciate you, you know, showcasing all different types of music. That's one of my favorite things. Working with Crossover, that's my personal favorite thing to see, is when people just have like this huge expansive sort of like program that I find that really exciting. So thank you for that.
You are most welcome. For more information, ZacharySwansonMusic.com and 577, that's the number 577, 577Records.com. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host the Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. To contact us about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or info@wgxc.org. We appreciate your feedback. feedback@wgxc.org or leave a 3-minute message at area code 518-291-WGXC. Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.